Finally, you know those movies you pull out time and time again when you can't figure out what you want to watch? Our colleagues at Weekends on All Things Considered regularly ask filmmakers and actors about the movies they never get tired of watching. Today, rapper and actor Common tells us about one of his favorites.
Peace, this is Common, and I'm an artist and actor. And the movie I've seen a million times is Coming to America, directed by John Landis, starring Eddie Murphy, Arsenio Hall, and James Earl Jones. I first saw Coming to America when it was released in theaters. I went to the movies with some friends of mine, and we loved it. No matter how many times I've seen it, I still laugh. Just like yourself. I would say it's about an African prince who, the way his tradition in his life is that he was set up to be married by his parents, and that's just the way it usually is.
She's your queen to be.
But he decided to go find a wife that he really would love and somebody he chose to be his wife. So he left from a country in Africa to come to America to find his queen, his lady, and he actually came to New York, ironically enough, to Queens, New York.
Halt! Take us to Queens at once.
What part of Queens you want?
Take us to the most common part.
That's easy. There's one thing Queens has got a lot of. It's common parts.
First of all, it just was funny, and Eddie Murphy was already one of my favorite actors because he just was so funny. When I see him, it's like he had a certain natural thing about him that just was great. And you don't even, like, try to pay attention to, like, well, is his accent, does it really sound African or not? You just were in it from the beginning.
Hello.
Hi.
I am Akeem. I have recently been placed in charge of garbage. Do you have any that requires disposal?
You know, you can't help but love some of the barbershop scenes when Eddie Murphy first came in.
Joe Louis, the greatest boxer ever lived. I'll be with you boys in a minute. He was bad at Captain Clay. He bad in Sugar Ray. He bad in that. Who that? The new boy had. Mike Tyson looked like a bulldog. He bad in him too.
He had a tail, and he decided to get that cut. And you know the barbers in there who were played by Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall. They were just talking, you know, about these guys from Africa, like just kind of looking at them strange.
Boy, what's that? Some kind of weave or something?
It is my natural hair. I have been growing it since birth.
What kind of chemical you got in there?
I have put no chemicals. Only juices and berries.
Seeing somebody as great as Eddie Murphy do what he does.
When you're away through here, God each day, to be loved, wow, what a feeling.
His acting influenced me in a way that made me want to be a star.
That was actor and rapper Common talking about the movie he's watched a million times, the Eddie Murphy classic, Coming to America. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Scientists place the origin of the very first primates, the group that includes humans, apes, and monkeys, way back in the deep past, about 55 million years ago. Fossils from that period are rare. But now there's an exciting new one. NPR's Christopher Joyce reports on what scientists make of it.
It's called Archicebus, roughly meaning beginning long-tailed monkey. Actually, this creature lived before the monkeys we know of today, 55 million years ago, a mere 10 million years after the dinosaurs died out. But Archicebus had some primitive features we associate with monkeys and the rest of the primates. It had big eye sockets, for example, and they are angled in a way that meant the animal had good stereo vision. It had nails instead of claws and grasping digits and other unique traits. Many of these would have been good for living in trees and perhaps capturing insects.
It's a fossil that shows a combination of features that we've simply never seen before in any living or fossil primate.
Christopher Beard is with the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh and worked on the team. The fossil was discovered by a farmer in China. Alive, the animal weighed an ounce and would fit in the palm of your hand. The skeleton's completeness and its great age are extraordinary. It was a special time in evolution. The first primates were emerging. Over time, they would evolve and diverge into numerous body types and behaviors, some becoming monkeys, some lemurs, and one would eventually evolve into us, Homo sapiens. Beard says the lineage Archicebus was on may not have been the one we came from.
But in any case, the take-home picture should be that here is a fossil that's very, very close to that evolutionary divergence.
And apparently that divergence happened in Asia. Writing in the journal Nature, the scientists say Archicebus may be the earliest primate skeleton ever found. Duke University anthropologist Richard Kay says, well, maybe. It's a murky field of study. Some other primate fossils might qualify. But Archicebus was certainly close kin to the first primate, and it could help answer some crucial questions.
Why did this group of animals get really well-developed vision? Why did they get rid of perfectly good claws and start to have nails on their fingers? And a lot of other characteristics. They beg an answer as to why did this change occur.
Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Mainstream country music has been dominated by men in cowboy hats for a long time now, even with the crossover success of stars like Taylor Swift. Some industry watchers think 2013 will go down as the year a new batch of young women emerge big time. To explain the latest trend in country music and bring us a sampling of some of those sounds, we turn to NPR's music critic, Ann Powers. Nice to talk to you again.
Hi, Renee.
So why don't you begin by explaining what you might call the voice of these new female musicians, what they're bringing that's different to country music?
Renee, as you know, there's always been amazing women working in country music, from the Carter family to Loretta Lynn, Dolly Parton, all the way up to the Dixie Chicks, and more recently, Taylor Swift and Miranda Lambert. But this year, there's been such a strong return to that gritty, honest, and very classic country sound that really looks at the lives of young women in small towns or suburban America who really are the main audience for country music.
Well, one of these new artists is Holly Williams. She's Hank Williams' granddaughter. Tell us about her.
She made a couple of records that were more commercial, more mainstream, but now she's returned with this album called The Highway. And this album is just gorgeous, like this song, Given Up, which is about a wife and mother who just can't kick her addictions.
We're only human, and we can't change somebody's will to leave their ways. But the doctor said you'd die if you had another drink.
Okay, Holly Williams. Another artist you recommend is Caitlin Rose, and I gather she grew up in the music business herself.
Caitlin Rose's mom has written songs for Taylor Swift. Her dad is also in the country music industry. She has a different sound than Holly Williams. It's more kind of vintage, and it's part of a change that's happening in Nashville itself, which is this company town is becoming more and more eclectic. Caitlin Rose reminds me a lot of early country artists like Patsy Cline with that country-politan sound. And here's one of my favorite of her songs. It's called Pink Champagne.
Here's to you, here's to me, and may we always feel the same. Let's drink ourselves another glass of pink champagne.
So a little bit, as you said, a little vintage there. So in this year of country women, I bet there's at least one more up-and-coming star that you find intriguing.
Oh, Renee, I have so many, but I want to share a scoop with everyone today. I'm really excited about this singer-songwriter whose name is Brandi Clark. She's part of this group of women, including Miranda Lambert and Kacey Musgraves. They often work together, and her own songs and voice, I think, are some of the most clear-eyed and tough-minded of the new country artists. She just has a no BS attitude about representing life, and I love it.
The judge said we're gonna have to start without the party of the second part, 'cause the party of the second part was MIA. He was getting drunk just like the day before, the day she got divorced.
That's The Day She Got Divorced, a great description of what it's like when a marriage falls apart, written by Brandi Clark, was recorded once by Reba McEntire, but you hear Brandy's own beautiful voice in that version.
Now that we've spent some time hearing and talking about these new female country music stars, what about a veteran, someone that you think is especially exciting this year?
I think there's no greater evidence that women in country are in a renaissance moment right now than the new album Spitfire by Leanne Rimes.
If I were to untie my tongue, I could use it like a whipping, watch you run.
Leanne Rimes, formerly a child star, recently fodder for the tabloids with her marital problems. But this new record, Spitfire, it's deep, it's intimate, it has an amazing sound. It's just an excellent record. And Leanne Rimes coming out on top, that's a beautiful mid-year capper to this Women in Country Music year.
Anne, thanks a lot for sharing all that music with us.
Thank you so much, Renee.
Anne Powers is NPR's music critic. She joined us from member station WUAL in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. You make me want to spit. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Linda Wertheimer.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We are going to spend a lot of time talking about China in the program today. President Obama is hosting China's new president, Xi Jinping, in California this weekend. They're expected to dig into some big issues like trade. But it's not just cell phones, clothing, and auto parts that are being exchanged. How about Hollywood blockbusters? In a few minutes, we'll talk about how Hollywood is trying to crash China's lucrative movie market and the kinds of accommodations movie makers are willing to make to do that. But first, we want to talk about something you might have seen where you live. The commander-in-chief is not the only one polishing up the welcome wagon. Local leaders from across the country have been seeking out investments from China. They've made them a top priority, and Mayor Michael Bell of Toledo, Ohio, is one of them, and he's with us now to tell us more. Mr. Mayor, welcome back to the program. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, China isn't the only place that you've traveled to on trade trips. You've been to Germany and India, but you've made four trips to China during your first term as mayor. And I wanted to ask how you developed that strategy, and what do you see as the upside, and is there any downside?
The way the strategy was developed was that we had some individuals that actually had come to Toledo on their own, and they basically invited us to go to China. We chose to do that because we thought it would be a wise move. We were a city at the time with about a $48 million deficit. We wanted to be able to reach out to other areas to be able to do economic development. And the biggest market at the time that I could think of was actually China. And they were doing fairly well with their economy. And so realizing that there are companies internationally that want to be able to put their footprint in America and they're looking for places to step off at, I said, well, why can't Toledo compete for that particular market? And that's what started this whole movement of visiting China and trying to gather their interest in the city of Toledo and the state of Ohio.
Well, I think that when a lot of people think about these international trade missions, they think about American officials going overseas to sell American products overseas. But it's much more of a two-way street now. Do I have it right? Or is it really much more you're looking for Chinese investors to invest in American companies or to build American plants here? Is that really more of the focus now?
That is the focus. We have a lot of products that just because of the nature of the market and things like that move around globally, sometimes it's just a matter of cost. And seeing that the costs are starting to balance out more from the standpoint of wages and things like that, it is actually beneficial in some ways for Chinese businesses to be able to move their footprint to the United States, because a lot of the products that they're making, they're shipping to the United States anyway. So if we could get that product over here and have American workers building that product, I think that it could be an extreme success. I mean, we have a Japanese company right here in Marysville, Ohio, that builds Honda cars, and they put a lot of Americans to work. So my whole idea is that we had, at the time that I started, we had an unemployment rate of about 13.8. I was just trying to come up with any idea possible to be able to put Americans and Toledoans back to work.
I understand that a group of Chinese investors purchased property near your Marina district about 2 years ago, and the project has broken ground, but the reports are now that there's some anxiety that the project isn't really going forward as fast as many people would like. And can I ask you about that?
Yes, and it hasn't. They bought the property, and I think that they're using the same type of intelligence when it comes to businesses that the U.S. business people are using themselves, because coming out of that recession, people are still not sure exactly where to put their money, and what they want to do is make sure that whatever they build has sustainability. And so until they feel comfortable with doing that, no different than an American business person, they're not going to do it. And I respect that, because they didn't get to the positions they're in making stupid investments. So they have an idea and a concept of what they want to do, and I'm quite sure that when it's time to move, they will move. My whole idea and concept was to be able to at least put the seeds in the ground, and hopefully something will grow out of that will help Toledo in the future.
You use the term, you know, they're just like American businesses in the sense of using the same kind of metric of decision making. But I'm wondering if there's a different reaction to this among constituents, for example, when it's a Chinese company versus an American company.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, you know, it is pretty clear to me that some people don't understand that here. That they expect something to happen overnight, and they're putting more scrutiny to these Chinese businesses than they would ever do to any American businesses that were in the same position. So I'm always battling that, but I know that if we give it a chance, and when I say a chance, somewhere within the 5 or 10 year period of time, that this will actually turn into something great. We already see movements from that standpoint, because before the business people who came here, Toledo would be an afterthought to them stopping. Now it's a primary stop before they go somewhere else. And so we've already changed the minds of business people coming here, that they see this as a high potential for being able to do business, and they're willing to still look at different operations inside the city of Toledo, Northwest Ohio, to be able to possibly put their companies there.
I'm talking with the mayor of Toledo, Ohio, Mayor Michael Bell. He's made 4 trips to China during his first term in office to forge business relationships. He's also received Chinese business people in his city. We're talking about the effort by local officials to attract Chinese investment into their cities and towns. Now, Mr. Mayor, can you talk a little bit more about I'm using this term, you didn't use this term, but I'll say double standard, that you think that there's a little bit more anxiety about Chinese investors or business people and investing in American areas than there would be if these were American companies, even if they're making the same kinds of decisions. Why do you think that is?
I think that a lot of it is out of a lack of education or on this particular situation, and realizing that our economy now is global and it's not basically local, meaning it's not just inside your city, it's not just inside your state, it's not just inside the United States. In order to compete, we have to be able to compete globally. And so this idea, for some people, is too far ahead, and they're more into things being more localized. Okay, why don't you go and find a company, you know, somewhere in Ohio and have them come here? Well, they're facing the same types of problems we're facing, and so they'd be robbing from Peter to pay Paul, and that's just not a good thing. So where I chose to go was where the money was. And I've been following the money on all these trips. When I went to China, I'm following the money. When I went to Germany, I'm following the money. Any place I go, when I went to India, I'm following the money. And there are large economies there that can afford to do the things that need to happen on this side of the globe to be able to help us out of our economic woes.
But,
and so that's what I'm looking to do.
You know, but there are also stories, though, about the working conditions in China, that there have been a number of, you know, exposés recently about working conditions in some of the Chinese factories. I think some people might wonder whether the attitude about workplace safety, relationships between, you know, management and employees is the same. How do you address those concerns? I mean, people, they're reading these stories and talking about workers working 6 and 7 day weeks, being on their feet for, you know, hours a day. They're hearing about, you know, relationships between, say, you know, management and labor that people just aren't accustomed to here. I think people might have diversity concerns. And you're talking about a workplace environment in China, which is not used to the kind of ethnic diversity that I think many Americans are used to. And I mean, how do you address those concerns? Or do you feel you have to? Or do you feel that just the regulatory framework, the legal framework that exists in the United States will take care of the problem if there is a problem itself?
Well, one of the things I will tell you is that I sat down on one of my last trips and I took a bunch of American businessmen and women from Toledo the last time I went, and they were just so impressed with the whole deal. But what I remember is that I was sitting down with a mayor, and he was telling me, he says, you know, I read all this stuff that you guys write about us, and he says, and then I walk around my own city, and he says, and I don't see it. He said, and I know that sometimes the stuff that I'm reading in newspapers in the United States about, or in China, about you all, isn't true. He said, but the only way you're going to ever really figure out what's actually happening is that you have to be able to look people in the eye and be able to figure out what the relationship's going to be. He said, you know, I can find homeless people and I can find this in the United States, but nobody's talking about that. He said, and it's no different than people being on the streets in China. And so if you want to make something a big deal, you can. I'm quite sure that there are some problems, okay, but my whole idea is to be able to try to bring things to the United States. And we have standards that we meet here that would take care of some of those issues if there are issues. But the other part is that we have people here who are working 2 and 3 jobs. So it's no different from the standpoint of how many hours a day people are putting in work, because the economy is so messed up that they have to do that, and they're doing whatever they need to do to take care of their families. And so, you know, it's just a matter of which way you want to frame it to be able to make one person look bad or another person look bad. I'm quite sure there are some issues that we could find right here inside our state of Ohio or the United States that equals some of that, and we're just not aware of it, or it's not on the radar screen.
Before we let you go, based on your experience, I know you're, you know, sticking into your wheelhouse, but do you have some advice for President Obama as he and President Xi begin their relationship, based on the relationships you've developed, you know, over the years and the experience that you've had, you know, over the years?
Well, the main reason that I travel there, and now we have a lot of business people who travel to Toledo, is that it all starts with a relationship, and it starts with looking somebody in their eyes, okay? And if you don't trust them, you're probably not going to be able to go anywhere with it. It doesn't make a difference what happens from that point on. It doesn't make a difference what they're telling you. It's about establishing a relationship to where you get and you feel that you can trust the person that you're talking. It doesn't mean that you can control their policies or their politics, but you got to know that when they say something to you, they're being fairly sincere. And so my only advice is that the president, with the new president, has established a relationship, and through that it'll benefit both countries and people in both of those areas.
Michael Bell is the mayor of Toledo, Ohio. He was kind enough to take time out of his very busy schedule to join us from there today. Mr. Mayor, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
It's my pleasure, Michelle. You try to have a great day.
Coming up, we're focusing on China today in advance of President Obama's meeting with China's new leader. Next, we talk about going to the movies in China. The movie market there is so big, American filmmakers are even willing to tweak their blockbusters to get in it, like Iron Man 3.
How many in the air?
13, sir.
How many can I carry?
4, sir.
How Hollywood edits for China. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
The NBA Finals begin tonight, and there is greater anticipation than normal as the Miami Heat host the San Antonio Spurs in Game 1. This series has it all. Superstars at the top of their games, coaches at the top of theirs, a defending champion Miami against four-time champ San Antonio. NPR's Tom Goldman has this report on the Spurs, whose prickly head coach has helped fashion a dynasty with a style of play that makes basketball purists swoon.
There was this play early in the second quarter, Game 4 Western Conference Finals between San Antonio and Memphis. Spurs point guard Tony Parker fired a one-handed bounce pass to teammate Boris Diaw, who was practically under the basket. But in an instant, Diaw saw a defender closing in and passed to center Tiago Splitter, who scored an easy lay-in. Parker to an open Diaw to a more open Splitter. ESPN's Jeff Van Gundy quelled through the slow-motion replay.
Well, the pick and roll, Parker gets it back to Diaw, which causes rotation. The little one-hand dish pass, that's a thing of beauty.
And that was a play with just two passes.
I could cite others where they might throw six passes in a possession. They're constantly in search of the best shot.
It's a philosophy of passing up good for great that ESPN NBA analyst David Thorpe says makes San Antonio's offense one of the best he's ever seen. Others, including Miami, play the beautiful game too, but the Spurs have been the standard bearers, Thorpe says, as they've adapted to recent changes in NBA defenses. The league has embraced more zone defense principles, where each defender doesn't have to be glued to his man. Defenders can drift closer to the ball. Thorpe says the way to beat that?
Great shooting to space the floor, share the basketball, move the ball quickly.
Of course, if all this doesn't result in the great shot, say against a supremely quick and athletic defense like Miami's, the Spurs can rely on point guard Parker, whose addition of a great shooting touch to his cat quickness has made him a defense-shredding force. Which brings us to Greg Popovich, the man considered the architect of the Spurs system. Everything leads to Pop in San Antonio, mostly for better, sometimes for worse. The veteran head coach has led his team to four titles since 1999 and eviscerated many a sideline reporter along the way, as he did here with TNT's poor David Aldridge.
How happy were you with the shot selection, even though they came back?
Happy? Happy's not a word that we think about in a game. You got to think of something different. Happy. I don't know how to judge happy.
Fair enough.
In the middle of the contest, nobody's happy.
You see this real sarcastic hard ass, and he's from the Air Force Academy.
Dan McCarney blogs about the Spurs for the San Antonio Express News.
I think it's very easy to typecast them.
When in fact, McCarney says, Popovich is so much more, intellectually curious and open-minded enough to allow his Spurs to evolve and be relevant for more than a decade. Of course, he growled in a Sports Illustrated article that his only coaching innovation was drafting Tim Duncan. The all-star forward has been in lockstep with Popovich on court and off, evidenced by an exchange with reporters this week. Duncan was asked about Pop's verbal tussles with the media.
I think it's hilarious. I think it's awesome. But as I said, he's direct. He says what he needs to say and he gets out of there.
Meaning, don't expect much if some brave soul asks Popovich over the next week or so what it would mean to win a fifth title. Probable answer? We won more games than Miami. Tom Goldman, NPR News.